I wish this were a joke, but it's not funny. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Great to be back with you again, and I too would love to be able to say April Fool. It is April and there is a fool involved, but I can't say April Fools on this, unfortunately.
Yeah, and sadly, this is no joke, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to take today and probably tomorrow's program to unpack an interview that was done on the Sean Hannity program. Now, our kudos to Mr. Hannity for actually pulling this individual onto his program so that they could show and give us a lesson on bad presuppositional thinking, Chuck. It was on his program, and it was last week during the Supreme Court's deliberations on the two cases in front of them, one dealing with the California Proposition 8 and the other one dealing with the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, regarding whether or not those who engage in homosexual behavior should be granted the same classification as the natural married couples, man and woman marriage. These are big issues that the Supreme Court is wrestling with. Of course, they probably won't come down with a decision until sometime in the summer, June probably. But Hannity actually had on as his guest a contributor to CNSnews.com, that's Cybercast News Service, CNSnews.com, by the name of Terrence Jeffrey, who's no stranger to our program. We've talked about his writings and used some of his articles to discuss major issues of the day here on this program before. Well, Hannity had Terrence Jeffrey on, and no, it's not Jeffrey who's got a bad presupposition. It was Sean Hannity's other guest, Chuck. It was the Reverend Oliver White, who is a minister who Hannity had on discussing with Terrence Jeffrey this whole issue on the idea of homosexual marriage and whether or not it is something that is supported by Scripture. To say that Reverend White's comments and thoughts and presuppositions on the matter are the thing of an April Fool's joke, Chuck, I think would be an understatement.
A gross understatement. Once we hear this interview, we're going to see what the major problems are. What you're going to see, ladies and gentlemen, or what you're going to hear, what you're going to hear is a complete abandonment of the basic principles of the Christian faith in favor of a remade new form of quote-unquote Christianity in which Jesus Christ is a great philosopher and teacher, but not the Son of God. And that the Word of God is not actually something that is inerrant and permanent, but God is not immutable, but changes his mind over time. You can't make that case from the Bible. The God himself says that I'm immutable. There's no shadow of turning with me.
He says, I am the Lord your God who changeth not. I think it's a fairly clear statement of where God stands on the issue.
Right. So what you're going to see, and when we get to that point, Barry, I have looked up this man's theological background, and you won't be surprised.
No, I probably won't.
No, but what we're going to talk about is the presuppositions that are involved here with the two people talking about this issue, and what the Christian presupposition is versus this sort of, let's face it, this is Gnosticism.
And for our folks in the audience who haven't heard some of our other programs, Gnosticism is, well, I guess it's a belief, Chuck.
It's
a broad-based belief that anything that's material or physical is bad, and anything that's spiritual is good, but spiritual is basically defined by man himself, and man has higher, more secret knowledge than what God has.
Yeah, exactly. And this is more in the line of the secret knowledge, basically, that there are some of us in certain levels of Christianity who have a secret knowledge that those nasty old fundamentalists and people who cling to the Bible don't have. It's simply because they take a narrow interpretation of that Bible, and therefore, if they don't broaden it out, make sure that the words mean different things, then they don't really understand what it all means. So this is what's going on, and this is Gnosticism writ large. It's rampant right now through the church, but this is not the first time in church history this has been a problem. Throughout, really, the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries, Gnosticism was rife, and if you'll hear a lot of people talking about how we need to accept certain gospels that have been quote-unquote left out of the Bible. Well, some of those are like the Gospel of Thomas. A number of the books in the Apocrypha are along this line, and that is that they're false gospels. They're gospels that take on the name of one of the apostles, but they don't count because they weren't actually written by those apostles, unlike Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Peter, Paul's writings, those kinds of things. These were written in the second and third centuries for the most part.
I think, Chuck, the reason why we want to talk about this is because this thinking is permeating not just society, but it's permeating the church. Reverend White is not the first or the only man who calls themselves a spiritual leader to take and twist the Bible and say that, well, it doesn't mean what it means, or, well, just because God said that doesn't mean that that's actually how he does things. And that seems to be the theme that Reverend White sets here. As a matter of fact, the headline at CNS News in announcing this article says, Reverend on Gay Marriage, quote, today Jesus would be inclined to say, you know, I didn't know it all. Well, for a man who's supposedly a man of God, a reverend, to have those words even pass his lips should be grounds, Chuck, for church discipline to be started with, because Christ was the Son of God. He was perfect, and he was just as God was. He was all-knowing. He was omniscient and omnipotent. He knew these things that were coming to pass, and he did know it all. Now, I hate to say it, Solomon was only the second wisest man who ever walked the earth. Christ was the first.
Right, exactly. And that's what the problem is here, Barry. We have people who have walked away from the orthodox understanding of the faith and have gone over into this way of looking at the faith that allows a whole lot of different things to come up and to do a kumbaya and say, well, everybody's blessed. All you got to do is believe that Jesus Christ was a great man. And you'll notice that a lot of them will pay lip service to the idea that he's the Son of God, but they don't really believe it. They believe that he was this great teacher. It's essentially a form of Unitarianism, which encompasses Gnosticism. That is, very often, it's a deistic belief. In other words, that God has set things in motion and he sits back and watches and doesn't intervene direct in any situation. So what we're dealing with is a kind of a mishmash of heretical beliefs that have plagued the church since its inception. And it's all coming to fruition once again. The seminaries are turning these guys out. And because they have the mantle Christian, it's easy for someone who's trying to tear down what Christians are doing to go to these guys, to go to these people inside the church who have really abandoned Christianity and say, well, you're a Christian minister. What do you think about this? Well, it's a guarantee you're going to get this mishmash of Gnosticism, Unitarianism, rejection of Christ as the Son of God and a deity equal with God in and of himself, in favor of this idea that God is still speaking. You may have heard that phrase, God is still speaking, which means that the Bible isn't the end-all and be-all, which I believe we hear this man say in this interview.
Well, let's go to the interview now, because it's a fairly long one.
We're not going to get through it today, in fact. I think you and I should probably plan on stopping and commenting as we go, and that way we...
I think that's exactly what we'll do.
All right, the Defense of Marriage Act, Day 2, signed into law by Bill Clinton in the 1990s, being debated before the Supreme Court today, as we have been playing. Joining us now is Terry Jeffrey from CNS. He's the news editor-in-chief at Reverend Oliver White, Grace Community United Church of Christ. Gentlemen, welcome both of you to the program. What is your take on the remarks as they are being reported today? Terry?
Well, I think we have a huge question here that goes to the core of what American law is all about. You know, the Founding Fathers and the Declaration of Independence said men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. In the 20th century, one of the greatest documents, I think, written by any American in that century, Martin Luther King, said, a just law is a law that comports with the law of God. He was quoting St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine. And now we have here in the United States people going to the Supreme Court and claiming that there's a right to same-sex marriage, which is a right I don't think that they can justify in terms of the principle of the Declaration of Independence that was used to back up the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s.
What's your response, Reverend?
Well, my response to that is, how can we suggest that what they're fighting for is not a just issue? We're talking about a human being with a sexual orientation that is different from what we consider to be the norm. But when you consider that 1 in 10 people happen to be either gay or lesbian,
where did you get the 1 in 10 people from?
Well, that's a statistic that I came across from a very reliable source.
You mean the Keynesian study from years and years ago that, in many ways, I think, Terry, correct me if I'm wrong, had been debunked?
Sean, I think the Census Bureau has shown that there's about 3% of people who claim same-sex orientation in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's not 10%.
Well, I would want to know what publication was that. I mean, how can you argue that?
The U.S. Census Bureau.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
There was a major stumbling block that, unfortunately, the good Reverend just face-planted over.
You're right. He was face-planting earlier, Chuck, because,
well,
you know,
first,
when he was pressed on where did he get his statistics from, he said, well, I got it from a reliable source. Well, what? Stop.
Yeah.
Which reliable source was it? He believed that all he had to do was say that out there, and that just basically ended the discussion because, whoa, it's a reliable source, so therefore your data must absolutely be right, and we should never question you on anything else about this again. Now, what he's trotting out is that 1 in 10 fallacy that has been prevalent, Chuck, probably since about the 1980s in this debate. And has been
if you go back to the Kinsey study, it goes back to 1949.
Well, yeah, I understand that, yes, the study goes back to 49, but the usage of it as a conversation stopper in this homosexual rights debate started in the mid-80s when they really embraced that idea and started pumping it out there that 1 in 10 were homosexual or had homosexual tendency. But again, what it gets down to is he was coming up with a statistic that had been thrown about by homosexual rights proponents that he embraced and grabbed onto as truth. But then he was faced with hard data, actual truth, that contradicted what he had to say. And as you so well put it, he did a faceplant.
Yeah, this is very often what happens when you get into presuppositional discussions. What you can prove, and Greg Bahnsen made this clear, it doesn't matter how much evidence you supply. This is why evidential arguments often fail in presuppositional. Right.
Especially if the evidence that you provide is wrong.
Well, exactly. What I'm saying is that people, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, very often hold on very tightly to false beliefs. And this is one of those cases. You notice that he didn't automatically say, okay, well, he's okay, let's move on, basically, was what he wanted to do. Okay, we've already had that point refuted. Let's see how many points on my little Death Star that I'm holding in my hand we can make stick. So what's happening here is he's going to keep coming up with argument after argument. Now, that's pretty normal. Normally, if you're called in to be interviewed on a radio show, you got kind of more than one argument you're going to make, hopefully, because if you don't, you're in trouble, as unfortunately Reverend Oliver White has just discovered. We're running really short on time, Barry,
okay. But
maybe we can get one more point in.
Sure.
Where did you get your statistics from?
On the other hand, I just think that here we are trying to legislate morality on the basis of what we read in the Bible.
Don't we legislate morality? For example, thou shalt not kill is in the Bible, and you're not allowed to kill somebody, right?
Absolutely, but don't we legislate morality in terms of thou shalt not eat shrimp? That's in the Bible. It's in the same book of Leviticus that talks about the issue
of
gay and
lesbian. So your take as a minister is that you think that this is just an alternative lifestyle, and those that claim that biblically this is not is not within, for example, the Judeo-Christian model of morality, you say are just absolutely wrong.
We're running out of time, so we need to stop there. There's lots more to go, but let's talk about that for a minute. What's the presupposition? Sean also made a presuppositional error, but that's really not all that shocking. The presupposition there is he didn't take the point far enough. Okay, it says don't eat shrimp in the Bible. It also says don't eat lobster, blah, blah, blah. Those are what are known as the ceremonial laws.
Right, the dietary laws, yes.
The dietary laws. Barry, the dietary laws in the book of Acts are wiped away.
Yes, they are. That was an area where they were given for a specific purpose. Because think about it, Chuck, unless you're at the edge of the ocean and pulling it in and eating it right there, usually what you're doing is you're finding your food and you're storing it and you're moving on. How well does seafood keep in, shall we say, desert temperatures?
Well, unless you can fly it on a plane packed in ice, not very far.
Not very far. But the whole point is that there are the dietary laws were things that were given to help us health-wise, but God didn't want them to be made to be an absolute standard for whether or not you were righteous or not. But the whole idea of keeping your body temple to God and honoring and doing as he says, which is that a man and a woman shall leave and cleave to each other, not two men or not two women leaving and cleaving to each other, because there are reasons for it. There are specific reasons biblically for it, and we'll talk about those more tomorrow on our program.
And we are out of time. Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.